Hello. I am so excited to get to be here today. When they asked me if I would come and give this talk, I was like, are you kidding? Are you sure? Yes, please. Because this is also one of my favorite conferences. And there's very few times that I get to write the word fart in a title that I give at a national conference. So you gotta like live the dream. So I'm really happy to be here today to talk to you about my journey as a nerdy girl with Dear Pandemic and how we use science and humanism to fight misinformation, predominantly through the COVID-19 pandemic. And I will answer the age-old question, can you get COVID from farts? So these are my disclosures. I am a volunteer author and editor for Dear Pandemic as one of those nerdy girls. I don't have any financial conflicts of interest, but I am super nerdy, as was mentioned, like D&D, I've met Weird Al kind of nerdy. And I promise some fart jokes, and there will be some. Sorry, it's over lunch. So these are my objectives today. I want you to be able to define the infodemic and what we all do as family physicians to help combat the infodemic, how we can use science and health literacy best practices and a little bit of humor to share good information and utilize humanism to improve health literacy for our communities. So this is my first nerdy reference. So let's go in the Wayback Machine to the brilliant days of 2019. This was how my colleagues decorated my desk for my birthday in 2019. So I was 5 years out of residency and into practice, and I was practicing as core faculty at Banner University at a very good residency, and I loved my job. Like, everything was great. It allowed me to do all of the things I really loved about family medicine: education, direct patient care, community engagement, addressing the social drivers of health and equity, being around friends and colleagues who really shared this mission, and I was starting to get my feet under me. 5 years in, you kind of start to figure out what you're doing. And so I was starting to feel settled and like I knew what the heck was going on. And then, of course, it felt like the next day the world was this, which was very different. Obviously, this wasn't a sudden change. People who were more astute than I was knew that this was coming, but I really didn't. I really felt like this was gonna be like the last SARS pandemic, where everything would kind of be okay. It would get under control quickly, we'd figure it out. It was far away, it was never gonna touch me or my patients. And obviously, I could not have been more incorrect. Because we all woke up to a brand new world, right? Suddenly, my husband is at home on a sewing machine, sewing masks for me and my patients and my colleagues. This is also when I learned that my husband could sew. So that was exciting. Those were good days. But it also meant that for the very first time, I was putting up very real physical and emotional barriers between myself, my patients, my friends, my families, my colleagues in ways I'd never had before, right? I was scared to go to work. I don't know if any of you felt like that, but I was really terrified. I didn't know what I was gonna get myself. I didn't know what I was gonna give to my patients or my friends at home, and I hated it. I was terrified. But I was also so proud to be a family doctor in those early days, and of course, continuing on now, because this is where we stood up. So as family medicine, we were called to fill every place that anybody was out sick, right? We filled in the hospital, the ER, the ICUs, the skilled nursing facilities, every clinic. We took care of all the behavioral health crises. We filled the gaps. And this is when I felt so inspired and proud to be a family physician, again, in a way I've always felt, but really tangibly so, right? Because I'm watching my colleagues around the world be courageous and adaptive and brilliant and doing incredible things. And this was a moment that was like, yes, we can do this. But it also meant that all of our work systems changed, right? Like, not just the practice changed, but where we were and how we were doing it changed too. Thank you. Suddenly, we're in a virtual world, which really does feel like a séance sometimes. Because we had to start setting up telehealth, right? We'd never done telehealth in my system before, and suddenly we're doing it all the time. We had to figure out how we work collaboratively with each other, even though we're in an office 4 feet apart, but now over Zoom or some other telecommunication system, right? And I was very, very fortunate, and I felt very lucky when my husband's job said it's all work from home now, so I didn't have to worry about him anymore. This is his first day of at home work. He wore a tie to look serious. It also felt like a time of incredible uncertainty. It felt like daily, or sometimes even hourly, everything changed. The minute you were like, okay, I kind of know what's going on. I've got a little bit of a groove. Then everything would be swept out from under you, right? Suddenly, it was new information. That old information you had was wrong, or slightly wrong, or maybe really wrong, or could be better. And it was very, very hard to keep your feet under you, because what we were experiencing was the infodemic. Have you all heard of this phrase before? So the infodemic is defined by the World Health Organization as an excessive amount of information that makes it really hard to know what to do and to make good health choices. Infodemics are deadly. There is no doubt that people died as a result of the twindemics of the COVID-19 pandemic and the infodemic. The infodemic is spread by very much people like us and well-meaning people, but also more sinister actors that we'll talk about too. It allows misinformation, disinformation, and just genuine confusion to confuse people. It causes distrust in public health and us as healthcare professionals, and really makes it challenging for people to know what to do. So misinformation is false or inaccurate information. Disinformation is its more sinister cousin, that's false information which is intended to mislead. And unfortunately, disinformation is incredibly common. And so the conspiracy theory person in you might be asking, well, who benefits from the infodemic? Why would anybody go around spreading disinformation? And unfortunately, lots of people benefit from an infodemic and from disinformation. There are a lot of folks with direct financial gain from spreading misinformation. Two of the biggest winners in the infodemic are the nutritional and wellness industries and tech companies. So nutritional and wellness industries invest heavily and profit from anti-vaccination campaigns, right? Think of, why get a vaccine when you can boost your immune system with vitamin C? Very, very common. Tech industries also heavily profit from anti-vaccination content. Annually, 58 million people see anti-vaccination content online, and this generates $1 billion in revenue for tech companies, because the more views means the more ads means the more money you make. People also, of course, as we all saw, use the infodemic and the COVID-19 pandemic for political gain. Throughout the world, across every political ideology and spectrum, it was ubiquitous. And of course, there are intellectual conflicts of interest. People who have a strong core belief benefit from spreading that strong core belief, whether or not it's true. Lest you worry that we were exempt from that, we were not. We also spread a lot of misinformation and disinformation and as a part of our care and communications with the public. A lot of this was spread by immediate and widespread sharing of scientific information without vetting. So think things like preprints that were out there. This is where hydroxychloroquine had its heyday, was a preprint, right? That just went to town, and then once we actually peer-reviewed it, we went, ooh, that doesn't work. We should stop doing that. There were a lot of healthcare professionals making strong statements without evidence. Some of this was well-meaning in an attempt to help people cope and navigate, some of it not so much. There are a lot of multiple people spreading information that seems very credible but conflicts with each other. And we're not always super good at evidence-based medicine. We are also susceptible to the infodemic, and so sometimes we get swept away right along with it. So who spreads mis and disinformation? Of course, it's social media, traditional media, political leaders, businesses, but most commonly, it's your weird uncle. That dude on Facebook that just likes and shares everything that they've ever seen. I have many of those weird uncles. I hope you have fewer. But they're everywhere, right? Because how we gain and obtain information now in this pandemic is different than it's ever been in any pandemic ever before, right? Our cultural literacy and accurate availability of information is different. Fewer and fewer people get their information from trusted health professionals or reliable, fact-checked print resources. More and more people get it from their friends, their family, a celebrity, and then, of course, the most common place people get it is from the internet. And I think this is the best representation of the internet. The internet is a hotbed of mis and disinformation, right? It can be a tool to connect and promote information with people, but it can also be used for evil instead of good. Health misinformation is one of the most prevalent things on the internet. Health misinformation in 2020 was viewed 3.8 billion times on Facebook, and only 16% of that had a warning label that this was misinformation. Social media promotes misinformation because of how it works algorithmically. It promotes things that are splashy and catchy and get your attention and have an emotional grab, which tends not to be the truth. Things that are emotionally grabbing tend to be misinformation or more commonly disinformation, and so people like, click, and share. The more they like, click, and share, the more social media says, this is good, and promotes it. And then promotes to you similar information along those lines, so you see more and more and more of it. So it further kind of entrenches you in that bubble. Things that have misinformation in it are 70% more likely to be shared than something that is accurate. So, you know, the internet is dark. And misinformation in the infodemic is harmful. We know that the infodemic has caused lower vaccination rates, beliefs in false cures, absolutely has promoted unsafe behaviors, and worsened health disparities for the populations that are already oppressed and marginalized and already had the hardest hit outcomes for the COVID-19 pandemic. It also fosters a lack of trust, which we already are struggling to earn with our communities and populations, and has increased harassment and threats to public health and healthcare workers. I hope many of you have not been threatened as a part of your care and working on a primary care team, but I bet you have. And I'm sorry that that's happened, and this is a big consequence of the infodemic. And then, of course, there's conspiracy theories. This is a prime time for conspiracy theories. So if you're a conspiracy theorist, live it up. This is your chance. We probably all had some version of this conversation with our patients. Medical conspiracy theories aren't new, right? Remember the books in the 90s that were like, the anti-aging tips your doctor didn't want you to know. I don't know why you didn't want them to know that, but there you go. So none of this is new, but it is most definitely amplified by the COVID-19 pandemic and the infodemic. And conspiracy theories are tricksy. They provide a very comforting explanation during episodes of powerlessness, anxiety, and uncertainty, which most definitely the COVID-19 pandemic meets that definition, right? It's a warm blanket that people can wrap around themselves when they feel out of control. Conspiracy theories work really well because they message around core values and emotions, and they tend to use pre-existing biases and prejudices. A lot of the conspiracy theories use all of the IST tropes we already know. Frequently, they use racist tropes, anti-Semitic tropes, xenophobic tropes, transphobic tropes. All of the terrible prejudices that exist in our world are co-opted into these conspiracy theories to help get more and more folks involved, which is, of course, heartbreaking. We know that social media spreads it, right? Because they're flashy. It's way more interesting to think that like a lizard people government is running the United States than the government. So it spreads. And it feeds into confirmation bias. It gives people information they want to be true, and so they say, yes, this proves it. You can identify conspiratorial thinking because it has a really unique pattern of thinking, and most people who believe in a conspiracy theory are not conspiratorial thinkers. They're able to break out of this pattern, but there are some that just are not so much. So a lot of the research in conspiracy theories actually comes from the climate change folks, no surprise, and so they came up with an almost good acronym. They were so close, they just needed an E. and quite nail it. But you can identify conspiratorial thinking because their thinking tends to be contradictory. They can hold multiple divergent beliefs at the same time because the belief that the official account is wrong is more important than any belief in any of the explanations. They also have an overriding suspicion of whoever the man is, right? Whoever it is that is, you know, propagating this conspiracy, and that that person has nefarious intent that is coming to get you. They have a deep and core belief that something must be wrong. And usually they're right. Something is wrong. The pandemic was wrong. It wasn't great. So that one I'll give them. But they also believe strongly that they are both the victim and the hero in this story. They are a persecuted victim of this conspiracy theory, but they are the brave antagonist that is taking on that conspiracy theory, and it gives them a sense of power and control they otherwise don't feel. These folks are immune to evidence. Y'all met those people, right? Like, the more you argue, the more you give them evidence, the further this proves, the deeper the conspiracy goes. And that's where they're going with it. Any evidence you get is proof that it's a further conspiracy, and they cannot tolerate randomness, right? The idea that something can just happen by chance is unacceptable. It must mean something. So y'all met some conspiracy theorists, okay? Here in family medicine, of course you have. Sometimes it feels like they're everywhere, and the good news is that they're not. Most people aren't conspiracy theorists. On the subreddit conspiracy, there is a ton of users, and over 2 million posts, only 5% of people actually exhibit conspiratorial thinking. But those 5% of people do 65% of the commenting. There was one dude who actually wrote so much, he wrote the Lord of the Rings trilogy worth of books twice. So they have an outsized influence. It's in this setting that I found myself joining Dear Pandemic and those nerding girls. In the world of the infodemic and conspiracy theories and COVID-19 and trying to figure out my place as a family physician in this new world, I found myself with this incredible group of women. So Dear Pandemic is a social media-based science communication platform made up of an interdisciplinary team of volunteer women, clinicians, and scientists from a whole lot of different backgrounds. So we have expertise in medicine, nursing, behavioral health, demography, epidemiology, immunology, vaccinology, all sorts of things. You name it, there's probably someone on our team who does that. And we publish to social media and other content 1 to 2 posts a day, answering questions that our readers have about COVID-19, the infodemic, information and health literacy, and just any other health topic that they can come up with. Our goal is to be evidence-based, simple, actionable, and a place where you can go that is safe to get information that you know that you can trust. So our origin story. The pandemic's raging, everything is wild, it's March of 2020, and one of our founders, Dr. Malia Jones, who is a social epidemiologist who studies vaccination patterns and herd immunity and where you live and how that impacts whether or not you get a vaccine, and she's getting a ton of emails from friends and family that are like, what do I do? And she's like, I don't know. So she writes a letter to them that's, I don't know, as well as what she does know. Here are some things that you can do in general to stay safe. Stay at home, social distance, wash your hands, the usual things that we did. A lot of things that she wrote were true. A lot of things that she wrote weren't true, ultimately, when the evidence came out. But it really went viral. So her friend said, hey, put this on Facebook. She puts it on Facebook, and it goes nuts. She starts getting tons of emails from people with questions, fears, and then the misinformation also hit. So this is a star chart someone sent her proving something about COVID. I don't know. She also got numerous copies of Michael Crichton books to prove that COVID-19 was developed in a lab. And then Dr. Phil called and said, come on my show. So she did. And this is when she realized that friends and colleagues were having a similar experience, right? That people like us were fielding questions for our friends and networks and communities about what can we do. So she put together a team of women PhD-trained scientists to start answering these questions. and see if we can help each other out. By the end of March, Dear Pandemic was formed with these women. They lovingly and jokingly referred to themselves as the Nerdy Girls, and then some news outlet picked it up, and so it's stuck ever since. So that's our name. So at this time, I wasn't on Dear Pandemic just yet. I wasn't in this network of women and scientists, but I was serving on the AFP Commission on Health of the Public and Science, and serving as the subcommittee chair for clinical recommendations and policies, which means that mostly I lived and breathed COVID. I spent so much time reviewing COVID data. So my job was to review all of the reams and reams and reams of stuff for the AAFP to help them make policy and recommendations and to guide us in family medicine about what we can do for COVID-19 care. One of the Nerdy Girls, Dr. Lindsay Liniger, did a town hall for the AAFP, which I hope you got to watch. It was very good, talking about misinformation and disinformation and how you can navigate it. And the AAFP CEO interrupted her and jokingly said, "You're missing a family doc." And she said, "Okay, great. Know anyone?" And then they called me. I had no experience in social media or large-scale communication. I had a Twitter account. I probably had like 100 followers, most of which were probably my residents. I had a Facebook account that was predominantly cat-based videos. So I didn't really feel like I had any knowledge or expertise that would make me a good fit for this particular skill set and role. But I love evidence-based medicine, and I love health literacy communication, and I, fairly or unfairly, felt like I wasn't doing enough in the pandemic. And you may relate to that feeling, right? I was feeling hopeless and scared and wanted to do more. And so when they asked me if I would join, I said yes. So I joined by August. So this is some information about us at Dear Pandemic. We have about 5 million views per month of our content. We have over 200,000 regular followers to one of our various platforms. Our platforms include our website, a newsletter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Parler. We're all over the place. We answered over 2,000 questions, so predominantly we answer people's questions about the pandemic because we want to give information that people actually want to know. We started a Spanish language version called Querida Pandemia with over 50,000 followers. Between the group of us, we've made 566 media appearances, which is not my favorite part of the job. We've been selected to be in the Library of Congress Coronavirus Web Archive, and we're featured as a case study by the World Health Organization. Lest you think we are too full of ourselves, this is the type of thing that is now in the Library of Congress. So that's cool. So we answer questions like, "Help, I'm having poop problems. Is pandemic poop a thing?" The answer is yes. And then we were cited by a number of journals and community organizations as a reliable resource because we've spent a lot of time building a brand that is trustworthy. So this is a New England Journal of Medicine article that puts us up there with PolitiFact, the CDC, FDA, and Mayo Clinic as a reliable resource. So this is just a brag slide because I'm very proud of this. So what I really want to do is share with you some of the lessons I've learned going through this process with Dear Pandemic and how it's helped me be a better family physician and maybe some things that you might be able to take away in your practice and in teaching family physicians. One of the most important things I've learned is how valuable social media is. Social media kind of is a little cringy, right? It might give you a little bit of the heebie-jeebies, fair. It's also a dark, dark world, but it is where our audience is. So we know that more than 100 million adults obtain their health information online, and about 70% of all people make their health decisions based on something they've read online. So we as family physicians need to get our message out to the internet, to that little place, and start to help spread that good information. Most people are really bad at finding information on the internet. The average adult can't find what they're looking for about 60% of the time. So we wanted to have a resource where you could go and know that you're going to find information that is accurate. Social media content also allows you to be timely so that when something comes out, you're not waiting 3 weeks to publish a newsletter or to go on the news or to write a journal article about it, that you can address it right then and there because that's when people care. 2 days later, it's gone. We all have no attention span, right? So we have to address things as it happens. It lets us use our network to spread that information, so it uses all of us to help spread good information, and we co-opt the tricks that misinformation uses for evil, for good. So you want it to be splatchy and catchy and have poop emojis all over it so that people will share it and like it and move that content along. It also let us be a two-way communication with our readership and audience. We answer readers' questions, and sometimes our own questions. And every time we do, we identify who the question asker is, and then we'll let them know afterwards. Hey, we answered your question. Did this help? Would you like something different? We also started doing live videos so that they could meet us as people and get to know us and ask questions on air. And we respond to comments on their posts. So everybody who comments on our posts will go in and respond to in some way or another. But most importantly, it allows us to gauge in real talk, in those questions that people really do want to know, like, can you catch COVID from a fart? This is really important because we also take on, you know, critical questions like, how do vaccines work and should I get the vaccine? The answer is yes. But that's not where we get people, right? We get people in the questions they want to know, like, how do I trick or treat safely? I want to go visit grandma. How can I do that? Is that okay? And these are questions they're often embarrassed to ask or don't know who to ask. And maybe organizations that are less likely to put a poop emoji on things are more embarrassed to answer. So this lets us build trust with people and to start to engage them where they are so that then we can take on those deeper, harder, more emotional topics. The summary of can you catch COVID from a fart is technically yes, but it's very hard to do. And we can go into how if you want in the future. So really what this meant is that we were human beings connecting as human beings to people out on the internet. So we bring ourselves and our voices to the content that we are sharing with our communities. One of the most popular posts that we ever wrote was the day I got my first COVID vaccine. So I was the first person in our Dear Pandemic group who was eligible for the vaccine, so I got it first. And I wrote a post about what that meant to me. And I poured all of my fear and hopes and trauma from the last year into that post, and I was really vulnerable, and I was terrified that I was gonna get eaten alive by people for sharing this vaccine, because people were still really hesitant about the vaccine. And this was a good moment for me because it allowed me to share with our readers me. And the response was overwhelming. People were so kind and rallied around me. I cried more than I've ever cried in reading comments to that post. But it also let a few, if not many, people feel like it was safe to get the vaccine because they saw someone they knew and trusted from the internet get a vaccine. And more than one person reached out to me to say, I feel like I'm doing my part to help the healthcare community by getting the vaccine. So be you with your patients, with your communities, because they respond to that and they will embrace it. And it's scary and vulnerable and you might get hurt, but it also is much more likely to pay off in the long run. Now, of course, we're very silly. We really lean into the humor of what we're doing. I really like this cartoon. But we know that using humor allows us to capture someone's attention, right? It is the trick that gets people to post and like and share. So every Sunday, we just post a cartoon about something that has no content. It's just like, here's something funny that we found. Humor also is effective at highlighting misinformation and forcing your brain to do the cognitive work to figure out what the good information is so that you get the joke. Nobody likes to be on the outside of a joke. And people are much more likely to like and trust you if you're funny. There's a reason that John Oliver, Jon Stewart, and Stephen Colbert have all been amongst the most trusted news sources in the United States, despite all of them being comedians, right? People like you and trust you when you're funny. So lean into the joke. It's okay. And as you're doing all of this, you need to make sure, of course, that you're staying culturally humble. And I will tell you, this is something that we have struggled with. Not because people didn't come into this with the goal of cultural humility and wanting to be inclusive, but because when we started, we were predominantly a group of white, well-educated women. And so our readership was white, well-educated women. which isn't who we wanted to reach necessarily. We also wanted to reach white, well-educated women, but those weren't the people that were being most hit from the infodemic, so our reach was really limited. So early on, we said, we have to do better. So we recruited intentionally for diversity and broadened our group of women that we were working with, but also we wanted to make sure that people were bringing in ideas and concepts and viewpoints to fill in our blind spots and to help us reach out. It also meant that we needed to check our egos, which, you know, is hard, because we had to recognize that we were not the right messenger for everybody. While we would love to be the right messenger for everybody, and we're very proud of the content that we make, we're not. We're not a trusted messenger for every group out there. So we built what we call the Nerdy Neighborhood. This is an online community of a lot of different organizations that are doing this work to help foster each other's work and then promote it to the right communities. So when I'm not the right community, we can connect you to Impact for Health. They might be the right community. Or the Black Women Physicians who are doing this work. There's lots of different people that we connected to and built. It also meant that we gave each other hard feedback. So sometimes we would post something and someone would be like, nope. And then we had to go fix it. because we had to open our eyes to our blind spots, our biases, and ways that we were not being culturally sensitive. Because what we wanted to be is trustworthy. And so you need to be culturally humble to be trustworthy. We always acknowledge uncertainty. Our most commonly written phrase is, we don't know. Because we don't know. A lot of times we don't have the right answer, so we have to figure it out, or we write what the best available evidence is and say, this is our best guess right now. We'll update you when we have more information. We also have to admit mistakes. We were wrong just a bunch like everybody else was. We were late adopters of masking. We overemphasized fomite transmission. And we were on the group that thought ibuprofen might be bad in COVID. Remember that one? And sometimes you just have to be wrong. And so we often go back to our topics and say, here's where we were, here's where we are now, here's how science got us to this point, to help explain the scientific process to people to make sure that we remained trustworthy despite being wrong. We also had to admit hard truths, because sometimes the evidence doesn't do what I want, which is, I think, very irritating. It should. But sometimes it just doesn't want to play along. And so I have to go with what the evidence actually shows, whether or not that is consistent with the messaging that I would like to keep moving forward. We also had to be nonpartisan, because we are severely politically divided in this country and in many other countries. This does not mean that we did not address political issues when they came up or when partisan people were spreading mis- and disinformation. We would hit that head on. But we always took it from a place of science and fact and less on partisan ideology. We always cite our sources so that people can know where we're getting our information from. And we talked about that we come back and hit the same topics over and over and over again. We realized quickly that we were spending a lot of time pre-bunking. Pre-bunking is also called attitudinal inoculation. And that's when you make people aware in advance that someone's going to come and try and trick you. So this is a really effective strategy, more effective than debunking, and something that we do all the time in family medicine, but could do even more. And that's when we teach people about manipulative approaches using hypothetical or real examples. And to do this, it requires two steps. We need to explain that there's a threat. You might hear that the COVID vaccine is going to kill you. And then you need to refute it. The COVID vaccine is very safe and prevents serious outcomes from the disease. One group of people put together a whole compendium of strategies and tropes that were out there with COVID misinformation that we used to start building our pre- and debunking series. These were just some of my faves that pop up. Most commonly ones I've seen are the sinister origin theory, right? This came from somewhere and someone's spreading this disease. I really like Think of the Children, which is a particular campaign that centers misinformation around the health of kids and uses highly manipulative images for people. And then Dior, do your own research, which is just a lousy thing to do to somebody, where they state a fact and then put the onus on you to go find the good information. So we went through this compendium and found a lot of commonly used tropes and strategies that were out there. And then we built several series on them to attack them. This is an example of our logical fallacies series. So we did a number of publications that explain logical fallacies and not so genuine ways that people might try to have an argument with you. This is about sea lioning, which is when someone asks you a question over and over and over and over again with not really, they don't really care what the answer is, because their goal is to wear you down and to harass you into submission. We also started a series on statistics and how numbers are used against you, and a series on information hygiene. How do you find good information and know that if it's true or not? And of course, just like all of us, we spend a lot of time debunking things. And that's fact-checking, right? You give them good information based on bad information. Debunking is hard, time-consuming, takes a lot of work to do it, but does work. And there are four ways that we can debunk things. And this is stuff we do all the time in clinic or when we're teaching our residents and students, right? The fact-based strategy is when you simply state a fact. Let's say the misinformation you're dealing with is that there are microchips in the COVID vaccine, which, by the way, I am still hearing. The fact-based strategy would be to say, there are no microchips in the COVID vaccine. This is the least effective strategy. Nobody cares. The logic-based strategy is when you try to get someone to think through why this doesn't make as much sense. Microchips are kind of big, and this is a clear vial. You could see them if they were there. And if the government wanted to track you, which they do, they already track your phone. Like, what's the point? Seems like a lot of effort. Source-based is when you cite a source that somebody trusts. Your pastor says that there are no microchips in the vaccine. The World Health Organization says there are no microchips in the vaccine. An empathy-based is when we connect emotionally to try to help people come to something new. Like, it must be so scary to feel like there are microchips in the vaccine. I feel very comforted that there aren't. All of this is hampered by health literacy in the United States as well as in other places. So about a quarter of the population has a limited reading level in the US, about fifth grade or below. And the average reading level in the United States is eighth grade. In case you have forgotten what a fifth and an eighth grade book looks like, fifth grade books are always like, child uses empathy to help someone. So think like Wonder or Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Eighth grade books are always like, angsty teenager saves the world despite the adults. So like the last Harry Potter book or Maze Runner or Hunger Games. Only 12% of the adult population have proficient health literacy, and that means they understand their health insurance. So I'm betting if you're in my camp, you're not in that 12% of proficient health literacy. And most of us have limited numeracy, which is a challenge because we communicate information in health based on numbers almost solely. So at Dear Pandemic, we took a lot of effort to address health literacy and how we were writing and speaking to our population. So we always use plain language, and that means language that you can understand the first time you hear it without having to repeat it or have a further explanation. We write it at less than an eighth grade reading level, and we run all of our posts through diagnostics to make sure that we are sticking to this. And we avoid jargon or we define it when we need to. We focus on a couple key messages because no one can remember more than a couple things at a time. And we say those same messages over and over and over again in every post. We want to make sure that what we're talking about is clear and actionable. People don't care about information that doesn't directly impact their lives. So you want to come up with what are you going to do with this information, even if it's just you should continue to wear pants when you fart to keep it in. You want to tailor your information to your audience so that you're talking the right language to the right people at the right time. And then you want to be cognizant of framing effects. So framing is when you give the same information with two different numbers, but it means the same thing. So for example, 80% chance of survival versus 20% chance of death. If I say you have an 80% chance of survival, you might be like, yes. If I say you have a 20% chance of death, you're like, I'm not doing that. It's the same number, right? So at Dear Pandemic, we always write both numbers down so that everybody can understand however they like to frame their concept. We always use person-first language. This was my big initiative at Dear Pandemic, was to make sure we were using person-first language and following the AMA Inclusive Writing Guide. And we write like we talk. Ultimately, what we want to do is empower other people. We want to engage them to think analytically, to affirm the value of critical thinking, to show empathy without ridicule, and to link to good resources for them so that they can go further and not need us anymore. We would love to be irrelevant. And we want to equip our community with actionable skills, like information hygiene, health literacy, and skeptical inquiry. When they see an outrageous claim, I want them to be looking for outrageous evidence, right? It needs to make sense, and then they need to find the evidence to support it. We want everyone to be an engaged contributor to how we're having these conversations, because people are more likely to listen and learn and to move forward with you if they're actively engaged rather than lectured at. We also really want to focus on equity. We know that women have had an unequal burden in the pandemic, right? This has been well studied. Women have been asked to do more at work, more at home, more in the communities than anybody else. So one of our goals at Dear Pandemic was to amplify and lift up the voice of women scientists and clinicians who are living through this and working together to help support each other. Which was my next slide. There we go. We always preview and review each other's posts. We have a Slack channel. We have a whole channel that's just F the patriarchy, where sometimes we just grumpy. We have regular Zoom meetings and virtual happy hours, and we share our triumphs and challenges, just like I know we do in the family medicine community, right? This was something that was really important to me, because as I was struggling and I had my family medicine warm blanket around me, I also had the Dear Pandemic warm blanket around me, people who shared the goals of the profession of family medicine. We also did not allow trolls. No trolls allowed. There is no point in engaging with trolls. Y'all don't got time for that. No one has the energy for that. And it is not a fight that is worth having. So if someone is genuinely interested and has a disagreement with you, that's a different thing. Those are people you want to engage with and talk to. You want to see where they're coming from and see how you can help inch them along. But there are some folks who aren't, and it's very clear. And those people you do not need to spend your time and energy on. And of course, there are some serious challenges, which I know you all can relate to. This work is all volunteer, right? None of us are paid to do this, which means we are spending our time and expertise building this up that is uncompensated and not seen as either scholarly or critical work. Family medicine is a lot like that in a lot of ways, right? A lot of work we do is about health communication, navigating for people, helping people get what they need to do, which is often not seen in the health systems as productive work. It doesn't have an RVU associated with it, or scholarly work. And this is where I'm so grateful to organizations like STFM and the AAFP who continue to advocate for how important the work that all of us do really is. And that it should be compensated and seen not only as important work, but foundational work for the healthcare system to function. So here's a summary of some of our strategies. Let's learn, because you have to have some acronyms. So the L is for listening and empathy come first. We want to engage our partners. We should be transparent at all times. And we should source and vet our data rigorously. And then we should learn how to do science, right? And how to communicate science. We communicate by looking good. So we have good infographics, we think about how we're phrasing it, we put some fun emojis on it, we tell a joke. We want to give examples that are typically analogies. We want to use those rule of threes where you're going to repeat yourself a whole bunch of times. And you want it to tell a story that can help people remember and engage with that work. Okay, so let's bring it back to you guys and all of the work that you're doing. Because what I don't ever want to come across as, you should do more, because nobody likes that. And that is everybody's refrain for family medicine. You should do more. It's because you're all so very good at what you do and you're so highly skilled, but you all don't have time to add more things to your plate necessarily. But my hope is that you can do some of these things already in the work that you're already doing, and just add it in to how you might think about how you communicate with your patients, how you communicate with your populations. I also hope that if an opportunity comes that feels outside of your comfort zone, that if you have the bandwidth to do so, you feel comfortable taking it. This really pushed me outside of my comfort zone, and I thought I had no skills, right? Only cat videos. I was good at cat videos. But that wasn't true. I'm a family physician. I had a lot of these skills. These are inherent skills to the work that we do all of the time. And so you are highly skilled, and you are a trusted messenger, one of the most trusted messengers in all of healthcare. So I want you to feel like this kind of work is absolutely your lane, and that you feel okay about staying in that lane and taking it. So here are some resources for you. You can't read that, sorry. But we'll put the slides on the app. And I just wanted to say thank you so much again for having me and letting me come talk with you all. Here is a bad joke. You're welcome.